Last week, Congressman Ed Pastor announced he wouldn't be seeking another term. That led to a number of announcements by elected officials, including Supervisor Mary Rose Wilcox and lawmakers Ruben Gallego and Steve Gallardo, that they'd be running for the 7th District seat. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, we'll focus on the plans of another possible candidate who already has a seat in Congress, Kyrsten Sinema. Will she stay in the 9th District or attempt to win in the 7th? Plus, the Obama administration has unveiled a proposal that would change how fighting severe wildfires is paid for, theoretically leaving more money available to prevent fires. I'll talk with Diane Vosick of NAU's Ecological Institute about the plan. Also, the state Senate has given initial approval to a bill that would prohibit the state from using the Common Core educational standards already implemented in most states. I'll talk with a conservative who believes Arizona's Republican lawmakers are making a mistake. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Still no sign that Russia plans to loosen its grip on Ukraine's Crimea, home to the Kremlin's Black Sea Fleet. Troops still surround some major Ukrainian military installations. Hundreds of pro-Russian activists have recaptured the regional administration building in the eastern Ukrainian city of Donetsk, hours after they were removed by police. Kiev accuses Moscow of orchestrating the protest to justify military intervention. The standoff that began November in Kiev over worries that Ukraine was becoming too closely allied with Russia has grown into an east-west crisis. Russia calls the new power structure in Kiev illegitimate. The U.S. and Europe embrace it. Meanwhile, back in Washington, Republican leaders say the House will be voting soon on legislation offering financial aid to Ukraine. NPR's Craig Windham reports the Obama administration is seeking a billion-dollar loan guarantee package to help Ukraine finance purchases of energy imports and reduce its reliance on natural gas from Russia.
House Republican leader Eric Cantor says a loan guarantee measure will be brought up for a vote quickly.
To give the administration the necessary tools it needs to tell Mr. Putin to stand down.
And House Speaker John Boehner says GOP lawmakers strongly support moves to help Ukraine.
We're here in a bipartisan way, trying to work with the president to strengthen his hand.
But Boehner says Obama could do more to reduce the dependence of Ukraine and other nations on Russian natural gas supplies.
He could expand our exports of natural gas.
Right now, there are tight export restrictions on U.S. oil and natural gas. Craig Windham, NPR News, Washington.
U.S. Supreme Court justices are considering arguments from today in an appeal by Halliburton that seeks to block a class-action lawsuit claiming the energy services company inflated its stock price. They threw out the company's first attempt to block the suit in 2011. Halliburton is asking the court to overturn a 1988 precedent that set off a number of securities class-action suits against publicly traded companies. In the Texas primaries, Republican candidates Greg Abbott and John Cornyn cruise to easy victories in the race for governor and U.S. Senate, while Tea Party candidates upset some Republican incumbents further down the ballot. From Dallas, NPR's Wade Goodwin has more.
There's no question that the strength of the Tea Party inside the Texas GOP pushed conservative Republican candidates even further to the right. Incumbent Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst went so far as to call for President Obama's impeachment to try to fend off his three primary challengers. But Tea Party favorite and conservative talk radio host Dan Patrick stunned the pundits by beating Dewhurst by double digits. The two head for a runoff since Patrick fell short of the 50% mark. Senator John Cornyn, however, easily beat his Tea Party challenger Steve Stockman, who refused to actively campaign. Wade Goodwin, NPR News, Dallas.
Dow's down 31. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Gruber Family Foundation to help extend the depth of international coverage of the world's most significant issues.
Good morning from KJZZ News in Phoenix. I'm Bruce Drummond. A Navajo Nation lawmaker has renewed legislation to oust the tribal council speaker, who's facing bribery and conspiracy charges. A previous effort to remove Johnny Nays failed to get enough votes to pass. Since then, former Navajo lawmaker Raymond Joe pleaded guilty to conspiracy to commit bribery in what prosecutors say was a scheme by tribal officials to divert money to their families. Joe named Nays as a co-conspirator. Nays has maintained he did nothing wrong. Planned Parenthood has filed a lawsuit in federal court to stop new state-mandated abortion regulations from taking effect on April 1st. From Phoenix, Jude Joffe Block reports the suit challenges restrictions on medication abortions.
The regulations in question say that when doctors perform a medication abortion, the kind that can be done with drugs rather than surgery, they would have to follow the Food and Drug Administration's instructions on the medication's label. The legislators behind the idea said it would protect women's health. But the FDA guidance was written 14 years ago. Since then, medical professionals have come up with a new regimen they say is an improvement. It's a lighter dose of one drug and allows women to do part of the procedure at home. Planned Parenthood's president, Brian Howard, says if doctors are forced to revert back to the FDA protocol, it will be bad for patients.
You wouldn't want to be told, we're sorry, we can't do for you what patients across the country are getting. We have to use the standard of treatment that was in place 14 years ago.
The regulations would also limit the window that medication abortions would be available from 9 weeks into a pregnancy down to 7 weeks. Jude Joffe Block, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
KJZZ is supported by Bookman's Entertainment Exchange, offering musical instruments for sale or trade, in addition to books and family-friendly in-store events. 6 Arizona locations and hours online at bookmans.com.
Look for sunny skies across the valley today. We should see a high of 81 degrees. That's about 7 degrees above average for this day. Partly cloudy skies tonight with an overnight low near 56, and then cloudy tomorrow and a high of 82. Right now, under partly sunny skies, it's 70 degrees in Phoenix at 11:06.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning, I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, President Obama has unveiled plans to ensure funding for preventing destructive wildfires rather than focusing on fighting them once they've ignited. I'll talk with Diane Vosick of NAU's Ecological Restoration Institute. Also, the Common Core education standards have many conservatives up in arms. 4 years after Arizona lawmakers approved Common Core, with little to no opposition, the legislature is acting to overturn it. I'll talk with conservative education analyst Michael Petrilli, who thinks lawmakers are making a mistake in politicizing the new standards. Plus, the Arizona We Want Institute has hired its inaugural director. Darcy Renfro will tell us how to get polls and ideas to turn into action by the state's citizens and elected leaders. And Phoenix Theater has kicked off its New Works Festival. I'll talk with one of the organizers and one of the playwrights. We start today's program with congressional politics. Last week, 7th District Congressman Ed Pastor announced he wouldn't seek another term. A number of Democrats, including Maricopa County Supervisor Mary Rose Wilcox and state lawmakers Ruben Gallego and Steve Gallardo, had a Pavlovian response to the soon-to-be-open seat and said they'd be running to succeed Pastor. Then things got complicated as word spread that Congresswoman Kyrsten Sinema, who represents the swing 9th District, was considering jumping into the 7th District race. Reaction has been mixed as some Latino Democrats have tried to praise Sinema while discouraging her from switching districts. Democratic political strategist Bob Grossfeld of the Media Guys joins me to sort it all out. Bob, is Kyrsten Sinema right to explore all her options at this point?
Well, I guess it depends from whose point of view. Some people are referring to this as the possible Janet effect, referring back to Janet Napolitano, who went to Washington with the president and, from a Democratic point of view, left the state in the hands of Jan Brewer and the Republicans. In other words, possibly good for her, but bad for the Democrats.
Should she be thinking about that? It didn't seem like Governor Napolitano thought too much about that.
No, she didn't. Much to the consternation, I think, of a lot of Democrats. I think on the whole, it's probably not a great idea for her to be trying to do this. At this point in time, the Washington Democratic establishment is not too thrilled with this possibility. Their concern is that if she were to try to jump districts, that it would make CD9, her current district, vulnerable to a Republican, and that then would create three potential swing districts in the state, and possibly the loss of two, if not three. And that's something they clearly don't want to risk.
Bob, we don't know necessarily at this point what the issues are going to be. We don't know if the support for the Affordable Care Act is going to hurt Sinema and really not matter, because depending on how she sells herself and sells it. But it doesn't seem like the potential competition in CD9 is all that daunting. Do you think that would affect her decision?
I don't think so. I mean, the ones that are Republicans that are in now, Wendy Rogers and Andrew Walter, probably not going to cause her a lot of heartburn. I think the only risky part is the degree to which Republican Congressional Campaign Committee and the Republican National Committee are willing to put money into the race in order to try and knock her off. But she's sitting there with $1 million in the bank and, you know, and 2 years in office. So it makes it a challenge, and I'm not certain that the Republicans want to take her on in CD9.
Let's come back to the risk of this for Sinema in the big picture. She is considered a rising star, no question, and part of that, I would guess, is because she was able to win in a swing district, but she also has other qualities, too. Does it change how she's viewed, even in terms of her future potential, if she were to go into a district that is very safe for Democrats? And at the same time, could she face a backlash from folks who say, well, we thought you were a little bit different, and now you're just like all the other politicians?
Yeah, I think that's a real risk for her to consider. And frankly, I would be amazed if the Sinema camp is not currently polling on issues like that. If you look at the really good reporting that Bram Resnick did, showing that she had assembled her team over the weekend, part of the team is Lisa Grove, her pollster, and it takes a day or two for her to put together a poll, and then they would have not been in the field yesterday because of the death of the Phoenix police officer. And so the odds are that she will have polling data within the next 48 hours. And at that point, I suspect there'll be more coming out of her camp and either a yes or a no.
Well, what do you think this means for folks like Mary Rose Wilcox, Ruben Gallego? Are they either behind the scenes or through third parties trying to tell her what to do or encourage her to do something else?
I think they're all trying to encourage her to do something else, such as stay put. You know, you've got a number of people who are looking at CD7, at least three of whom, and you mentioned them, Mary Rose Wilcox, Steve Gallardo, and Ruben Gallego, who are already in the race. Chad Campbell is another one who may be seriously looking at it. And so to the extent that they're already committed or about to be committed, certainly they're sending messages as strongly, I think, as they possibly can for the Congresswoman to stay in CD9.
If you were behind the scenes working for the Sinema campaign, what kind of polling would you need to see to determine we need to make the jump?
I suspect I would need to see a polling data that shows overwhelming support and that would not create a backlash effect against her within that district, as is starting to show up over the last 24 to 48 hours.
Bob Grossfeld, Democratic political strategist of The Media Guys. Bob, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
And word has come down this morning that one of the candidates Bob Grossfeld and I just talked about, lawmaker Steve Gallardo, came out publicly today as gay. It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein. How complicated is Kyrsten Sinema's decision? I'm joined now by Jay Heiler. Among other positions, he was chief of staff for Governor Fife Symington and campaign spokesman for former Congressman Ben Quayle. After redistricting, Representative Quayle chose to run against fellow Congressman David Schweikert instead of running in the then new 9th District. Jay, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. What was the decision-making process? Can you take us behind the scenes a little bit with the Quayle campaign in determining whether to run for a new seat or to take on a fellow congressman after redistricting sort of put things in flux?
Well, there were a couple of points that were Ben's focus. The first was, you know, where was his existing district? And the newly drawn district that he ended up competing with Representative Schweikert for actually was comprised of almost two-thirds of Ben's original district. So Ben was really staying as much as one could in those circumstances in the district he was already sitting for. And then the other thing that he thought about, I think, most was, you know, who do I want to represent? And so Ben Quayle is a conservative, and he felt that he wanted to represent a conservative district as well as the one that he had already been elected to represent. So that's what drove his decision.
So though there are clear differences, how similar is that to what Kyrsten Sinema is thinking about? Because if she were to go to District 7, based on what you're saying about what Representative Quayle did, she would be representing a clearly Democratic, a more left-of-center district as opposed to District 9.
Yeah, there are some similarities on that level if one is calculating it there. There are also some differences, though. You know, Representative Sinema has been voting and caving and communicating as a moderate centrist Democrat for the district that she's in and that she was elected to after running a very fine campaign. And so now she would be seen by some, I don't really know if it would be by the voters who really matter to her, but she would be seen by some now as just, for utilitarian reasons, pivoting and moving over to a different district and changing her spots that she has had on display since she was first elected. So there's some risk in that for her. Some people would take a dim view of it. But the only thing that matters is whether the voters would take a dim view of it. And, of course, it does matter who does she want to represent. If she wants to represent a more swing type of district, there are some benefits to that when she tries to run statewide at some point, for example, for a Senate seat. But there are some risks involved with it, too, because she might face a primary challenger who would seek to exploit a moderate voting record in order to take away the nomination. So, you know, that could cut both ways as well. But, you know, if you look just beneath the surface here, these two situations are radically different. Hmm. If you recall, the redistricting process that happened in Arizona was controlled by and large by the Democrats. It was the new map was drawn by a Democrat mapping consultant who had a long history of working for the Democrat Party in different states. And Ben Quayle was actually drawn out of his existing district by about 300 yards, a few houses, and put into the same district with David Schweikert to set up that conflict, or to alternatively force him to run in a fundamentally different district. And on the contrary, the district that Representative Sinema now sits in was, in many respects, seemed to have been drawn specifically for her for that cycle, and with a good degree of attention and care and cleverness, as many perceived it at the time. So now she would be moving out of that district and into another one, which I suspect beneath the scenes, behind the scenes in the Democrat Party, is one of the things that a lot of people would find galling about her making that move.
And as we know, redistricting lawsuits are still pending. And of course, we've also heard that fights among Republicans and Democrats, well, Republicans were smarter in 2000 and Democrats were smarter in 2010. But Jay, we've only got a minute, so I'll leave that subject for a second, though. Would it help Republicans, do you think, if Sinema ran in the 7th District, considering we're already in March, we already have a couple of Republicans who are ready to run in CD9, if she were to jump, does that make CD9 a really, really good opening for Republicans?
Well, it depends on who would fill her spot. You know, it's not inconceivable that a really strong candidate for the Democrats could run in that district and make it even tougher, not be carrying any of the burdens into the race that Representative Sinema might carry with regard to votes that she's cast or issues that have begun to shape the race. And, you know, it might localize the election and take it out of any national wave effect that could favor a Republican, if in fact that materializes, and no one really knows whether it will. So you don't really know. It all just depends on who the person might be, and it depends on who the Republicans nominate and how the race shapes up when those two individuals are put in the same frame.
Jay Hyler was chief of staff for former Governor Five Symington and a campaign spokesman for former Congressman Ben Quayle. He currently serves on the Arizona Board of Regents. Jay, thanks for the time today.
My pleasure. Good to be with you. Have a great day.
Still to come on Here and Now, we thought immigration reform was dead in the House, but that may not be the case. We'll talk about it coming up on Here and Now.
KJZZ is supported by Arizona State University. offering more than 60 undergraduate and graduate online degree programs. Class descriptions and registration online at radio.asu.edu.
Good morning, this is KJZZ's Here and Now. BBC NewsHour starts at 1, followed at 2 by The World. Checking conditions around the state right now, partly sunny skies and 50 degrees at the Grand Canyon. It's partly sunny and 48 in Flagstaff, sunny skies and 66 in Casa Grande. It's sunny and 67 in Tucson, and the state's hot spot right now is Yuma, where under partly sunny skies they have 78 degrees. In Valley traffic, there's a crash blocking the northbound on-ramp at Bell Road. Partly sunny skies and 70 degrees in Phoenix at 11:20.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein. The federal immigration reform saga continues. Many observers thought legislation was dead this year after conservative House Republicans made it clear to Speaker John Boehner that they wouldn't support it. Instead, they prefer to wait until the results of November's elections to see if the GOP could reclaim a majority in the Senate. Now the group FWD.us or Forward.us, led in part by Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg, has released a new commercial. It'll air in all 50 states over the next 2 weeks. It calls on House Republicans to act now on immigration reform. With me to talk about that is ASU political science professor Rudy Espino. Rudy, good morning.
Good morning.
What do you think of the organization's efforts to not let this issue die in 2014?
I think it's in some ways welcomed by certain groups to continue to put pressure upon the majority party in the House to keep considering immigration reform. But I also think that there's a lot of groups, activists more on the left side, pushing for comprehensive immigration reform that view Mark Zuckerberg's organization as pushing a very narrow approach to immigration reform, something that would have the effect of not addressing all immigrants, giving a pathway to all kinds of labor pools. Zuckerberg's organization is really focused on dealing with the backlog with high-skilled labor immigrants not being able to attain citizenship here, the problem with our H-2B visa system, and that really is the focus of this organization. So you have critics more on the left that say that taking such a narrow approach, if that is successful, then it would not address the millions of other undocumented immigrants that are also seeking a pathway to citizenship.
Rudy, at this point, are there positives to that incremental approach from this standpoint, that if House Republicans say they won't consider it at all, but then you have this focus from Zuckerberg's group on highly skilled labor, it seems like that's an issue Republicans have always been on board with.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that Republicans have also been on board with perhaps creating a temporary guest worker program. And that is what critics on the further left that are pushing for comprehensive immigration reform would be opposed to. Again, Zuckerberg's organization is focused on a very narrow approach, a very narrow segment of immigration reform. And the fear from some is that, or the criticism from some is that ignores, and Zuckerberg's organization ignores the fact that they're in Silicon Valley. Yes, there is high-skilled labor, but you also have need for low-skilled labor that other people will not be willing to do, being nannies, cleaning homes, cleaning yards. I would refer readers to a good book about 10 years ago, The Devil in Silicon Valley by Stephen Pitty, in which he makes the argument that that area of Silicon Valley was built on the back of Mexican-American labor. And so if Zuckerberg's push for this narrow immigration reform is successful, it would have the effect, according to some, that would push that unskilled labor force that Silicon Valley does need even further into the shadows where they already are, but even further into the shadows, because there would be very punitive consequences if getting caught after the passage of immigration reform.
So do you think that Democrats themselves, actually elected Democrats, are not as excited about this, a little nervous based on what you're saying about those who are left of center, how they feel about this particular action at this point?
Yeah, I think it depends on which Democrat you're talking to. You certainly have Democrats that probably represent the interests of Silicon Valley, and you have Democrats that represent interests of let's say, the Hispanic community that would not benefit to the extent, would not benefit as much as Zuckerberg's approach for immigration reform would have.
Rudy, finally, the head of the National Council of the Raza spoke out earlier this week and called President Obama the deporter-in-chief. What's your reaction to that, first of all, and how does that, if at all, affect the possibility for immigration reform?
Well, I think that is, you know, there is truth in that. Under this current administration, you've seen record levels of deportation, higher records of levels of deportation than the previous administration. And so for many on the left side of immigration reform, and particularly within the Hispanic community, feel that they've been betrayed by the current administration, by the Democratic Party that's in control of the White House, because this is a candidate who in 2008 campaigned. One of his platforms was comprehensive immigration reform. We're already into 2014, and there is no light at the end of the tunnel that there is pressure being applied by the White House, significant pressure according to certain individuals, upon House Republicans to consider comprehensive immigration reform.
Arizona State University political science professor Rudy Espino. Rudy, thank you.
Thank you.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Last year's wildfire season in Arizona will always be remembered because of the tragic deaths of the Granite Mountain hotshots as they attempted to fight the Yarnell Hill fire. But from the standpoint of how much land was lost and how many acres were burned, 2013 was not as harsh as we've gotten used to. Our drier-than-usual January and February, though, has many observers concerned about what 2014 will be like. Late last month, the Obama administration revealed a proposal that would change how fighting severe wildfires is paid for, theoretically leaving more money available to prevent fires. To get an Arizona perspective, I turn to Diane Vosick, Director of Policy and Partnerships at NAU's Ecological Restoration Institute. What do you think of the general concept the Obama administration is talking about for wildfire prevention funding?
Based on the way that we look at the need to increase prevention and treatments, it's a good approach to dealing with fire borrowing and the problems that have been created by these mega fires. In the past, as many people know, when we've had these mega fires, the Forest Service has had to borrow money from other accounts like management, like treatments, in order to pay for these mega fires. And so what's being proposed would stop that practice.
It seems like this approach would have made sense for a long time. Why do you think it's taken a while for something like this to be recognized, or at least some action to be taken at that high level?
Has always operated a little differently. What is being proposed now, and actually the original proposal came up from Congress, a bipartisan bill that was sponsored by Senator Wyden out of Oregon. But the Forest Service has always been an agency that pays as it goes in terms of the way it works. In other words, the Forest Service used to pay for management by selling trees, and it's always had this different approach than other federal agencies, and that could be part of the reason why it's always been expected to pay for its fire suppression out of its own budget. But nobody ever envisioned that we would start seeing the kinds of fires that we're seeing with the associated costs.
Right, those mega fires, it's been described in other ways, the catastrophic wildfires. Okay, so realizing where we're at and the fact that we've had some of the worst wildfire seasons over just the past decade or so, what are the best ways to use prevention-related money?
We know, based on our own research here at the Ecological Restoration Institute, that treatments work. So in other words, when you start restoring the forest and reducing the fuel load, and then do subsequent low-intensity burning, the kind of burning that used to happen for centuries, if not thousands of years, before the last 150, the forest is healthier and can withstand lightning strikes and fire starts. So our treatments hold up, demonstrate that there's a way of getting past this catastrophic fire situation, which just for people that are unfamiliar with this, when we talk about catastrophic fire, we're talking about unnatural fire in these systems, fire that goes from crown, treetop to treetop and burns severely. The forests in northern Arizona are accustomed to fire, but fire on the ground. And so what we know is if you can reduce the fuels, which is the only variable we can really control in this system, mm-hmm. because there are three things that contribute to fire: an ignition source, oxygen, and fuel. The only one we can really control is the fuel. And so we know how to do that, and we need to just, in our estimation, based on the science, just be more assertive and get on it.
Well, so how much has it hurt not having more prevention money available or more money committed specifically to that? Is there more to it than just getting more funding?
Well, there is. And because we're dealing with public lands, the agency is responsible for going through an environmental review process. And that's a good thing. They have to carefully consider what it is that they intend to do in terms of reducing those fuels. So that takes time. It can take anywhere from 3 to 5 years. So that there is that issue, and many people know there have been issues of litigation and stopping this work in the past. However, those issues seem to be softening, and we seem to be able to do more work. So it comes down to, at this point, really investing more in getting the problem done. And one thing also that we did a modeling exercise last year and discovered is that you can't just treat around towns. What we discovered in the Walla Fire is that the treatments around towns were very effective in protecting those towns. But what we have now are hundreds of thousands of acres behind the towns that have too much fuel. And so in order to stop the mega fire, we really need to be smart about carefully doing treatments in the larger landscape that break up these fuels and reduce this huge dynamic catastrophic fire behavior that we see.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with Diane Vosick, Director of Policy and Partnerships at NAU's Ecological Restoration Institute. So, Diane, when we talk about the fuels being available, trying to reduce the fuels, how much responsibility should homeowners who live in the wildland-urban interface take?
Well, that is the single most important thing that a homeowner can do. And there are many things that people can do to create a more fire-resilient private property, home, whatever. I just built a home myself, and there are fire-resistant materials you can put into your construction. But even if you are in a situation with an older home, there are things like making sure there is no flammable material touching your home. Believe it or not, a lot of these fires that ignite homes come actually creeping in from the ground. They can also be ignited through embers in your gutters. So up here in northern Arizona, it's extremely important to get your pine needles out of your gutter every year when the pine needles drop.
Diane, finally, how worried are you, how worried should any of us be about the 2014 wildfire season in Arizona? How much should we be concerned about this dry January and February?
The jury's still out in terms of whether or not we'll be receiving an uptick in precipitation during April and May, which is a little bit off kilter. We, generally speaking, it's better to get a good snowpack up here in the northern part of the state for purposes of water recharge and also for the fact that snow lingers and slowly melts into the ground. So if we get a lot of rain in April and May, that can help blunt the danger of fire season, but it's interesting in that it can also contribute to increased growth in understory, which could lead to increased fuels in June. And if we have a very dry June, that's the month we generally get big fires. So the prudent thing for everybody is to be treating around their property to take their own responsibility. And then we just need to increase our investment and our activity in terms of reducing fuels across the landscape.
Diane Vosick, Director of Policy and Partnerships at NAU's Ecological Restoration Institute. Diane, thanks for the time.
You're welcome.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. On Tuesday, the Arizona Senate gave initial approval to a bill that would prohibit the state from using a set of educational standards already implemented in most states. Arizona adopted the Common Core standards in 2010 without opposition, but some Republicans have recently denounced the standards, saying they're a poorly conceived, federally driven effort that usurps states' rights. Michael Petrilli is a conservative, but disagrees with Republicans who criticize Common Core. Petrilli is Executive Vice President of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. He'll be in the Valley on Thursday as part of the Phoenix Chamber of Commerce's Phoenix Forum. The title of his speech is Our Classrooms, Our Workforce, Our Future. Michael Petrilli joins me from Washington, D.C. Michael, how connected are higher academic standards and economic competitiveness?
That is essential. I mean, we know now that we are in a real competition with countries around the globe to bring work here to America and to produce products that the rest of the world wants. And that means we need to have workers who have high-level skills. And unfortunately, we're just not graduating enough people from our public education system that have the skills to take advantage of the many good opportunities out there in employment. I'd also say, though, more than the international competitive issue is this issue about income inequality and social mobility. You know, we're having a big conversation in this country today about how we can spur upward mobility, whether that has stalled. A lot of worries about this growing divide between affluent folks and less advantaged folks. And the big divide, you know, it used to be race, and it's not even exactly class. What it is education. I mean, people who are getting strong education, who are graduating from two-year or especially four-year college programs, are doing much better in this economy. And those who are not are getting left behind. And so we need to get many, many more of our young people prepared to succeed in college and to succeed in their careers.
How do we avoid there being, though, a have and have not situation where some districts are better funded? In Arizona, a big thing is school choice, but there's concern that with school choice, does that end up benefiting parochial or private schools more than the public school system? So are you, I don't know, in essence, robbing from Peter to pay Paul?
You know, I'm a huge fan of school choice, and I think that a strong school reform movement has both expanded parental options and also has strong standards and accountability for results. And it's that combination that really gives you this powerful 1-2 punch. You know, we need to be clear about where kids need to be by the end of their high school experience. And it's not some standard that we pick out of thin air. The real world has a standard. We know where kids need to be, for example, in reading, or in math, and writing, to be able to go on to college and start taking credit-bearing courses right away, to not have to take remedial courses to even get to the starting line. So we need to make sure that our public education system is aiming for that standard. At the same time, we do not want a system that is standardized. We want to make sure that there is opportunity within our schools for innovation, for different approaches, for making sure schools can be a good fit. You know, we know that every child, I mean, I've got two kids, I know they're very different. They're gonna need a different kind of education, or at least a different kind of teacher, to be most effective. So we've got to allow for there to be innovation and customization, while at the same time, we're aiming for some of the common goals, which is to get kids ready for the real world.
I want to come back to the economic impact potential of improving our educational system. Can that come if we emphasize only STEM, a lack of teaching about civics, about history, that sort of thing? Can those work in tandem, or do we need to focus on science, math, engineering, et cetera, if we're focused more on the economy?
No, look, we can definitely walk and chew gum at the same time, and we cannot give up on this traditional mission of the public schools, which is to prepare students not just for college and career, but also for citizenship. That's probably the most important thing that we are doing in our public education system. And we also know that starting at a very young age, if students are going to be successful, both as readers, both as being able to do math, eventually be able to learn science, we have got to teach them things like science, like history, art and music early. That helps them build their vocabulary. It helps them build their content knowledge. It helps them, as they read new material, make sense of it. So all of this fits together. You know, and so we cannot, you know, let some of our muscles atrophy while we build up other muscles. You know, we definitely need that well-rounded approach, and that is going to be what's going to help us prepare students to be successful. Now, many of those students are going to need to be able to go on to do advanced math and science and go into STEM careers, but there's lots of other opportunities in other fields that are going to take other strong skills, strong writing skills, strong analytical skills. So, you know, there's plenty of opportunity out there. The problem is that we're not coming close to preparing enough students, and I would say that Arizona is not coming close enough to preparing enough of its students to take advantage of these opportunities in any of these fields.
The state Senate has just given initial approval to a bill that would prohibit Arizona from using a set of educational standards, the Common Core standards that were adopted in 2010 without any opposition at all. What is it about Common Core that gets people so mad?
you know, unfortunately, there is the Common Core issue has been completely politicized. And what I mean now is that it's become really a political issue more than an educational issue. You know, some of my fellow conservatives have worries about the Common Core. They know that the Obama administration is in support of these standards and played a small role in encouraging states to adopt them. This was something that started out from the governors, from the states, but the administration did encourage states to adopt them and has on occasion taken credit for them. This has fueled a lot of the backlash. You know, keep in mind, we've got, you know, conservatives are, in my view, understandably angry about many of the things happening at the national level today. They don't trust the administration. And so when people hear that this has something to do with the president, they are instinctively opposed to it. What they need to understand is that this really is something that was started in the states and now is back in the states. And what it means for Arizona is stronger standards and particularly stronger tests. Arizona's had this problem where you're doing all this testing, but the tests simply aren't rigorous enough. And so kids that are passing the tests think they're doing fine, but they're not actually ready for what comes next. They end up going to college, and they end up being told they have to take remedial education, or they go to get a job, and they're told that they don't have the reading or math skills that they need. So, you know, this is a historic opportunity to finally raise the bar to where it needs to be, and I sure hope that we don't let politics get in the way.
Are there states that have implemented Common Core and have had success?
You know, it's early going. I mean, all of the states are on basically the same timeline. They adopted them now almost 4 years ago, and they have been retraining teachers and retooling their curriculum. For most states like Arizona, the first tests that come along with these standards won't be for another year, and that's really where the rubber hits the road. We do know that some school districts at the local level have gotten a head start, and we are seeing some promising signs. You know, we're seeing teachers doing teaching that is much more coherent, that allows them to go deeper. One of the goals of the Common Core is to try to get teachers to not feel like they have to cover as much material every year, but to be able to focus on the most important items in literacy or in math, and to make sure that kids really get a mastery of those things. Teachers like that. You know, these standards are strongly supported by teachers because they allow them to do higher quality teaching and learning because they're able to go deep. And where we see that, there's a lot of promise. You know, I'd also say that a state like Tennessee has recently raised their standards. This happened even before the Common Core, and they made their tests much more difficult. And they recently showed the biggest gains on the National Assessment of Educational Progress of any state, and actually the biggest gains in history that any state has shown. So I think what that indicates is most likely it's because Tennessee said, look, we are going to have higher standards. We're going to demand accountability. We're not going to set the bar so low. And their schools responded quite positively.
Michael Petrilli, Executive Vice President of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. He's in the Valley on Thursday morning as part of the Phoenix Chamber of Commerce's Phoenix Forum. The title of his speech, Our Classrooms, Our Workforce, Our Future. Still to come on Here and Now, we'll meet the inaugural director of the Arizona We Want Institute and find out about Phoenix Theater's New Works Festival. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Depression Recovery Centers, offering a holistic, personalized approach to treat depression, from ketamine infusions to referrals to psychotherapy to wellness plans. Screening info at depressionrecoverycenters.com.
Good morning. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM and online at kjzz.org. In Valley traffic, watch out for a crash blocking the left lanes on the I-17 northbound at Camelback Road. It'll be partly sunny in Phoenix today with a high of 81 degrees, a few clouds tonight, and a low of 56. Stay with us at 12 o'clock. We'll have NPR's Here and Now from Boston. China has increased its military budget by 12%, another sign it's becoming a dominant military presence in the Pacific. NPR's Here and Now starts at noon on KJZZ. Partly cloudy skies and 70 degrees in Phoenix at 11:43.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. About a decade ago, the Center for the Future of Arizona was established. Describing itself as a do tank, the center is focused on using public policy research to help solve some of the state's problems, including the percentage of high school dropouts. The next step was a collaboration with the Gallup Polling Organization on an elaborate report called The Arizona We Want, and identified 8 citizen goals, improving education and infrastructure among them. This week, the Arizona We Want Institute introduced its first director, Darcy Renfro, formerly of Science Foundation Arizona. She was also an advisor to former Governor Janet Napolitano, and Darcy Renfro joins me now. Welcome.
Darcy, you've been involved really extensively. I think when people think of you, they think of education.
Yes.
So where does the Arizona We Want Institute fit into that?
Well, the Arizona We Want Institute has 8 goals. They're the citizen goals. This is an agenda driven by Arizona citizens, and education is one of them. Of those 8, 5 are really policy goals that really require policymakers to make changes, and education is one of those. What citizens in Arizona want in education are kids to be ready for college and ready for careers. They want internationally benchmark standards. They want higher expectations for their kids. So it fits very nicely into what I was doing before with education and similar, and it's nice to know that Arizonans agree with that.
A lot of people are focused on the leadership we get from our elected officials. Do you think there's too much emphasis put on that when it comes to something like this, where it has to be more about maybe people driving the policymakers rather than vice versa?
I think it's both. And so that's what the Arizona We Want Institute is about. It's about driving people and driving policymakers to these goals. The agenda is big, and those 5 goals, there are 8 total, and the 5 are really depend on policy changes to make them happen. So in some cases, that is true. Policymakers have to start making decisions that will help move Arizona forward. There are 3 other goals that are really about citizen participation, civic engagement. And some of the things that we found in the poll, the Gallup poll that was done in 2009, are people love the state of Arizona, but only 12% of the people polled felt that people here actually care about each other. So it does take both people working and they're getting attached and involved in their communities and with their neighbors, as well as moving policymakers and policymakers as well as candidates for office, understanding what people here in Arizona really want and what they want them to focus on.
Arizona We Want Institute, in some ways at least, is an offshoot of the Center for the Future of Arizona. Mm-hmm. How do you get people, though, to say, boy, these ideas are great. I'm glad you got people who did the Gallup survey. They're excited. How do you turn thought into action?
That is always difficult, but that is the objective here. And what we've done is identify lead organizations and entities for each of those goal areas. Mm-hmm. And just last week had a convening of all those lead organizations with other organizations that over 100 people came. So leaders from all over the state in all different areas got together and started talking about an action plan to accomplish the goals. So that's a starting point, and that's how it's going to translate. The more entities and individuals we can get to understand the goals, sign up, believe in them, and start to move toward them, either collectively or in their individual day-to-day, we can accomplish those goals, and that's how we plan to move forward.
Is there a feeling that they're out of step, that the legislature is not in sync or vice versa? And how much of getting these leaders together is about changing a mindset or getting people to think we can work together?
I think that's a big part of it. What we did find was that only 10% of Arizonans believe that their elected officials represent their needs and their views. And so that's a problem. That is a disconnect. And so one of the short-term objectives for the Institute is to focus on candidates and elected officials and just let them know what the citizens have said, let them know what the agenda is. They can decide how best they want to approach it or what position to take, but they need to understand where the people of Arizona want to be. And we're hoping that will be the start of what will become a group of policymakers more attached to the things that Arizonans want.
Based on the status of the organization, can you get involved in primaries, for example? Will you endorse candidates at some point?
Well, we are a 501c3, so we're a nonprofit. So we can't lobby or take political positions, but we can provide information and we can build a movement toward the things that matter to Arizonans. We have to improve those numbers. We should have more than 12% of the people in this state thinking that people care about each other. That starts with your neighborhood, but it also starts with the policymakers we do elect. So we have had, since the poll was taken, over 10,000 individuals come in to the website, take the Gallup poll, and start to think about these issues and continue to gather their opinions. We want more organizations. Some have already done it. Copper Point Mutual, that is a good partner, a lead partner in this, has filled out a document that simply says, here's what we're going to do as an organization, as a business, to meet these objectives. So we're going to keep building that. The West Valley, as a region, has put together a strategic plan, an action plan, on how they're going to achieve these goals as a region. So more and more, we'd like to see more and more of that happening. We think that will all start to translate into action and we'll be able to accomplish these things.
How much do you think this disconnect. I use that word again, but this idea that 12% believe that other people care about the community. How much does that have to do with the fact that this seems like such a unique place? We've talked about this in other forums as well. The fact that a lot of people move here from other places. There are some people, those who are more well-to-do, who may only be here 7 or 8 months of the year.
Well, it is a challenge. We have a very transient population. We have to make Arizona an attractive place for young people, young talent, and we have to be able to keep them here. People love this state. They love its natural beauty. It's a phenomenal place to be. You can go drive from one end to the other and be in all kinds of different climates and so forth. But in terms of sort of a sense of community and that, you know, start with the neighbors. You know, do you talk to your neighbors? I mean, it could be that simple. Do you get involved? Do you come to public meetings? Do you engage or notify your elected official, whether it's their city council member, county board of supervisors, state legislator, or member of Congress? Are you telling them what matters to you in engaging? So we need to get people to do that. We need to get create a vibrant economy for people who want to build careers here and stay here. And so that's all tied in, you know, education, economic development, job creation, young talent, all of those things, and community engagement are really all tied together in building a strong state, in building a strong Arizona.
Are you seeing signs of that? There are some who actually would attribute the opposition to SB 1062, to this idea that the business community, a grassroots effort. So is there a feeling that there can be if you get people excited enough about it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's an example of how when there's a power in collective involvement. So you get a lot of voices together around the same issue, and things can happen and start to bring or have our elected officials either lead us or come along with us.
Darcy, you have been at Science Foundation Arizona. So how does it feel to be going from one position where you knew you had a good mission, maybe you didn't have as much support, and going into this, how do you get yourself ready knowing the challenges that exist, even if you're an optimistic person naturally?
Boy, you have to always rely on facts and data to help guide what you do, and integrity of the people that in the relationships you've built. I've built relationships in the state. I'm a native Tucsonan, actually, and I've been building relationships in this state for a long time. So the build on relationships and identifying people that get things done, and then relying on data and facts. And this Gallup poll really sets such a tremendous foundation to build from. That's what I think makes this the most unique initiative. So to prepare for it, I know the state. I feel like I know it well. And I'm just looking forward to kind of re-engaging in the relationships I've had at Science Foundation.
Darcy Renfro, the inaugural director of the Arizona We Want Institute. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. On Monday night, the Phoenix Theater's Hormel New Works Festival kicked off its 2014 performances. The festival runs through March 18th and features plays and musicals at the theater at 100 East McDowell Road in Phoenix. With me for a few minutes to talk about the New Works Festival are Associate Artistic Director and Festival Organizer Robert Colby Harper, Kathy Conroy, writer of What He Knew About Women, the music of Cy Coleman, and Mark Cornell, the writer of At Birth. Welcome to you all. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Nice to be here.
Robert, let's talk first of all about the New Works Festival. It's been around for a while. There have been some changes, though. Tell us about the space, what people can expect.
The festival, this is the 16th festival. After the 15th one, we did them in the summer, in July, every year. And it was hot. So we decided...
Hot, not in a good way.
Both.
Okay.
Which made it excruciatingly hot. so we decided to grow the festival. We really wanted to move it into our prime time of year. So this, with our new space, with our new black box that we just built and our new atrium lobby, this is the perfect time to move it. So we have two theaters, what we call the Hormel Theater and the Judith Hartz Theater. They're both black boxes, and we can run two stage readings at a time. And 4 years ago, when I took over organizing the event, I wanted to make it more festively, basically, and show our patrons the different forms of development. So we added two sit-down reads of new plays. This year, we're adding a composer-lyricist cabaret. We're featuring three new composer-lyricists and some of the music they're working on for specific projects. We have a playwright forum. We have a big improvisational event that next year we're going to turn into the genesis of writing short plays. We have an evening of short plays this Sunday, which is 10-minute to 20-minute plays. So we have a lot going on.
Kathy, a musical in this sort of setting Is it extra challenging in the sense that, having attended, I know that the actors are there with clipboards and whatnot. Is that different for a musical?
Yes. Under an equity contract, stage reading contract, they must use their books. And we're doing a Cy Coleman musical, What He Knew About Women. And so they have 24 hours of rehearsal. We have about 18 to 25 songs. Wow. And it's recorded, or it's arranged for three voices, solos, and lots of arrangements. So our intense rehearsal time for the last three nights has been mostly learning music, putting a brief kind of a skeletal staging to it, and we open on Friday night. So we are like a little freight train of talented women putting this whole little thing together, and it's going to be fantastic.
How long had you personally been working on it? And your career is extensive, but when you think about a New Works Festival, what excited you about that?
Well, as a director, you usually come to a project with your own idea. This was brought to me by three girls who wanted a director, and I knew them, and they had worked together, and they said, please help us move something forward. We had another idea. At first, it didn't quite come together, so we decided on a Cy Coleman. He is, you can't think of a better composer to be working for women. And so we started, I brought Susan Braden on board as a arranger, pianist, and musical director. And she, in the last year and a half, we've been working on this. And so Michael and I talked a little bit about it. We kept some conversations going, and he helped us continue a developmental process. And now we're here to see if we have done made some good choices.
Mark, how long did it take you to put this together? How long had you been planning it? And when you finally see people reading your words, how much work is still to be done after a New Works Festival, for example?
Well, I started working on the play about, 14, 15 months ago. And coming here and being part of the festival, a week-long festival, having extensive rehearsal time, it's great for me. I've done mostly short plays, and the rehearsal time for that is quite brief. But be able to go away and concentrate just on my writing for a week is terrific. And the support at the theater is fantastic.
Tell us about the premise of At Birth.
Well, it's an epic comedy about babies. It's set in the South, in the rural South, in North Carolina, where I live. And it's about the clashing of cultures between two very different couples whose babies were switched at birth by a disgruntled nurse. Mm-hmm. And now it's 9 months later. The two couples have found out about it and are getting together to decide what in the world should they do.
Mark, I want to start with you and Kathy. I want to follow up on this. What sort of expectations do you have for an audience like this? Because folks who go to New Works Festivals tend to be the folks who really, really like theater and have a lot of opinions.
I'm sorry, what is my...
what are your expectations for what the audience will bring? Yeah.
Oh, gosh. My expectation is that the audience will have a really good time and laugh. That's my expectation, yeah.
But then afterward, I presume there will be some... The folks in the audience will get to ask you questions. Are there certain questions you're looking forward to answering or no?
Well, let me help with that.
Okay.
We develop the questions that we ask the audience.
Okay.
After. So we work with Mark and figure out what he wants to know about his play.
Terrific. Okay.
Because it is about the playwright's process, and nobody's here to tell them how to do it. We just want to know what they got from it. So it makes the patron, the person who comes see it, they have an active role in the development of the process. They don't have an active role of writing it.
Right, of course.
But they have an active role of informing the creative people, the creative artists who are working in their project, on what they received and what questions they have and what didn't work for them and that kind of thing.
Kathy, about a minute left. I want to have you comment on that as well.
Well, I think for our show, we have three points. We want to entertain first. We want to amuse, and we really hope to have a little bit of inspiration. Even in a cabaret setting, it's possible with this kind of music and kind of arrangements.
Kathy Connery is the writer of What He Knew About Women, the music of Cy Coleman, featured at the New Works Festival Friday and Saturday. Mark Carnell, the writer of At Birth, and Robert Colby Harper is festival organizer, also associate artistic director at Phoenix Theater. The New Works Festival kicked off on March 3rd, runs through March the 18th at the theater at 100 East McDowell in Phoenix. Thanks so much to all of you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for listening. Thanks very much to Nick Blumberg for his help on today's program. That's it for this edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Stay tuned for NPR's Here and Now up next from Boston on listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. We hope you have a great day. It is 12 o'clock.